Welcome to episode 31 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick, and together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
So we are recording today, March 8th, 2016.
Yep. One day early.
Yep. A little earlier than we would normally go. 2 days earlier. And what would you like to start with this week?
The website's totally up to date.
Oh, awesome. The website is totally up to date. And I have my blog.
We have new project pages.
Yep. And we have new project pages. Mm-hmm. Mine is not up to date, but Patrick has started loading his. And so hopefully in the next few weeks you'll see.
Oh, you found a mistake.
I found just one little.
Oops. Sorry about that.
It's a glitch with the system.
The encoding.
Yeah, the encoding.
Yeah. I actually, a lot of times I read the blog on the webpage, but this time I only read it in the text file before it got converted to HTML. So I was under time pressure.
Yeah.
And it was a longer blog.
Right.
So it also makes it less likely that I'll read it over twice.
Right, exactly. So I did my blog this week on Elodia. We use Elodia we've used it for the last 3 years as we cover photosynthesis and cellular respiration. And it's a awesome plant where the students can use bromothymo blue as their indicator solution for carbon dioxide, and they can actually see how if they have higher levels of carbon dioxide in a yellow solution of bromothymo blue, then it will turn a nice blue when it's put into the light and the plant is photosynthesizing.
Yeah, so bromothymo blue is a pH indicator.
Yeah, it's a pH indicator.
And CO2 is
lowers the pH.
Yeah, it gets converted to carbonic acids and then
reduces
bicarbonate.
Yep.
And hydrogen ions.
Mm-hmm.
And carbonate and two hydrogen ions. So
it's a fun lab, great visuals for students. And this year we had to switch up the type of Elodia we use. Usually we use Elodia canadensis, and we had to switch to Elodia chara, which actually turned out for the best, and I was surprised with the results.
So I didn't totally understand. You couldn't see the bubbles as well on the chara?
No. So the Elodia canadensis, you get to see these nice little bubbles form. And with the Elodia chara, it wasn't as obvious to me.
Is it just because
I think it's the shape of the leaf. The leaf is much
thinner, so the bubbles leave when they're still small rather than sticking there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it changes the shape of the bubbles.
This reading about this got me really excited again to do that CO2 generator using yeast that we did one time.
Oh,
that'd
yeah.
That'd be a really cool
yeah.
student experiment.
And yeah. The students really like this one.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do the write-up of it, they're like, you can tell everything kind of fits in very nicely too. Oh, yeah. So in this case, it turned blue. In this case, it stayed yellow because it was in the dark.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a wonderful visual
that
students can use. And it's just a great lab. And it doesn't take very long. We only do it for 2 days.
This was so funny. I don't know if you remember. Actually, I'm sure you do. But so the bromophenol blue is, that's probably what we use to test the pH in our tank.
Probably, yeah.
You know, right? I don't know if, well, I'm sure you remember, again, we had an aquarium, and you, in your basement back in Brockville, you had this big piece of coral,
mm-hmm.
and we put it, we thought it would look neat in the aquarium. Yeah, we put it
like,
in there.
Oh, it looks so pretty.
Yeah, and it looked really cool in there. And then I'm testing the pH and it's through the roof, right? So I'm adding acid.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, good. Adjust it down. Check the pH the next day. It's like through the roof again. I'm like, what the hell? Add more acid. Check the pH. Okay, it's good. Check the pH this time like an hour later. It's gone through the roof again. I'm like, what is the deal? I'm emptying bottles of acid.
Right.
Fish are doing fine. The acid just disappears. I'm like, what is happening? And then after a few, like a week or so, it had happened gradually, so we didn't notice, but the coral was like basically looked like a lumpy rock rather than a nice sharp coral with things.
Yeah.
And yeah, then it hit us. Duh. Calcium carbonate.
That was fun.
Yeah. I kind of got a feeling. Didn't we talk about mine already? Because we did it.
Yes.
We did, because we did the last podcast really late.
We did. We did. So, and then we're doing this one early. And so
I don't think I have one to talk about.
Okay.
So we'll move on.
Okay.
Totally going against our new system.
I know. So.
I just wanted to talk about it.
What area would you like to.
Do you want
to talk about?
Go in the same direction as the last two? Start with the physics type stuff,
okay.
And go more that biological and then into computers at the end?
Yeah, that sounds great.
So I had no physics or astronomy, no chemistry.
Okay.
Did you have any?
Go
straight
I
into biology.
Know. So I'm sorry, I'm just.
You had a lot of Zika.
Yes.
So that goes with biology.
And then I had the ground zero, but that's more ground zero with developing computer or robots.
At Fukushima?
Yeah.
We'll do that after that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the, yeah.
I have, you also have Ebola stuff.
Right.
And then I have the Arctic shipworm.
Yes. That was a good one. I enjoyed that.
So you pick.
Okay. How about we start with the Arctic shipworm? Because that was shipworm. A pretty strange little creature.
Okay. So the Arctic shipworm story is from the February 26th issue of Science.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole story came about when researchers were interested in, I think they were actually interested in the shipworm. I don't remember exactly what they're looking at, but they're up in Svalbard, I think. I'm not sure. Anyway, it's very far north.
Right.
And they picked an area way to the north where only Arctic waters come in.
Right.
Compared to ones where Arctic waters mix with more southern waters.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to use that area to the far north as a control, because they figured there's no way anything can live up
right.
there in the wood. And they were trawling. The place is Rispafjorden.
I know.
Oh, yeah.
I love that name.
Rispafjorden.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking when I was reading this. Yes.
Anyway, it's a bay. And they were trawling and they brought up this huge log from 250 meters below the ocean, and it had shipworms in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, shipworms, you have got to look at the picture of these guys from either Google it, I don't know, but the picture on page 901. It's just amazing looking. It looks like it's screaming at you, and it looks just disgusting.
It does.
And it's the
something
mouth is
like alien.
I thought exactly that.
Yeah.
It's like people must have. I don't know. Anyway, so and they found shipworms all through the log, so that was a real surprise. because they're just 1,100 kilometers from the Arctic Circle.
Mm-hmm.
It's far down. The temperature down there is minus 1.8 C.
Right.
And and I think the shipworms, they believed at the time that there wasn't a species that could live or reproduce anyway,
right,
below 10, plus 10 degrees.
Right.
So, yeah, so, you know, this brings in the whole climate change, what's happening, are these mm-hmm. things moving north? You know, before they never really went further north than the southern end of Sweden. One big worry they have is that, you know, these people are archaeologists, so they're interested in sunken shipwrecks on, in
right.
the south. The ships don't last very long. But in the north, you have all these shipwrecks, or these sunken ships, I should say, that are just sitting there and they're well-preserved. And the worry is, well, if the shipworm are now able to move to the north, these will just all be eaten away before we have a chance to study them. And they routinely have rovers going down taking pictures and
right.
stuff. So how'd the worms get to this far northern place? There's two theories. One is that the log, it's pretty rare to find a log that big that mm-hmm. far north. So maybe the log floated up there and then
right.
sunk. Against that is the fact that they found some sediments in the log and stuff in the log that seems to say it's been there for a very long time.
Right.
The other theory is they're looking at either a new species of shipworm or something that's somehow adapted to the
right.
cold, the original species, but it's mutated or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and adapted to the cold. Another thing that's, according to them, makes them think that the worms who were living there is when they looked in the log, there were all different stages from the mm-hmm. youngest to the oldest type. So, let's see. The species is, well, they don't know the exact species of the ones they found. The most common one is, it's T. novalis, but I'm not finding the gene. Oh, Teredo. Teredo mm-hmm. novalis. Anyway,
and
that's all there is to it.
They're usually around 6 centimeters long.
Oh, they can go up to a meter.
But then the ones that they found were much larger, too. Because it says,
I don't know how large they were. I know there were many. Did they
say? Oh, they were saying at one site.
At one site.
Then I thought that they said they were larger in the log that they had pulled up. But maybe I was just thinking I read that.
7 meter log infested. No, that's the log.
Okay.
Oh, no, you're right. Trondheim, the site of the 6 centimeter long creatures, was more akin to a nightmare. Yeah, 6 centimeters long. I thought they went up to a meter.
Yeah, I had read something about there being variation in size, too. But very cool. It's a mollusk, too.
Yeah, it's a mollusk.
You know, it's just the weirdest looking thing. And so to think of it as a mollusk, I don't know. It just doesn't.
It looks like it's screaming.
It does.
And the whole mouth, it looks like a drill bit.
Yes, it does. It has the auger mouth.
Yeah.
Which drill into the tops of other
shells. So they're going to
shells.
They're going to cut up the log and send it to researchers all over the place. Different people are going to check out different.
That's a really neat discovery. That's fun.
Unfortunate.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. And I can understand the archaeologists like, no, what does this mean for us?
Yeah. It says, historical records suggest more than 1,000 shipwrecks dot the coasts around Svalbard. So this is just Svalbard.
Oh, I have a neat one. So there's two plant ones that I found.
Okay.
And one is, it didn't really, give me an article or didn't cite an article. But it was fun. It was it's plant defend themselves with armor made of sand. And so it talks about these plants that put out this residue and sand sticks to them. And oh my goodness, animals don't eat the ones that have sand stuck to them. And so it's one of their mechanisms. And I just thought it was really neat. And it also made me think of, you know, when we're out walking, what have we seen? And it'll make me look a little closer to see if there's a residue that's making that sand stick to them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
That was a really cool one.
Yeah. So I thought that was a fun find. The other one is the corpse flower has a cousin that smells like coconut. Much nicer than the corpse flower. And this flower is...
Arconsuloi.
Yeah. It's one of the... it's 10 centimeters across. And it there's a picture of it in the science article. And the... What is it? It's a shortened news or news briefs. And it just looks like a really cool flower. More like a pitcher plant, I think.
It's hard to tell. It's the picture's from the top.
Yeah. So. But anyway, it would be a fun thing to see. So there.
From the Philippines, Luzon.
Yeah. The other thing that was kind of neat, and it goes along with our biology, is this orangutan. It was a small article, and it's rewilding has led to hybrid orangutans. And I didn't know that there are two separate species of orangutans and at least three reproductively distinct subspecies. And when they were rehabilitating 90 orangutans and releasing them into the wild, they didn't realize that they were releasing them into different groups. And so there's this researcher that has been looking at this group of orangutans, and she's been following them since 1971 and to 1985, and they're looking at that data.
Well, that's the dates when they were released.
Oh, the dates that they were released. Since then, they've been following these individuals and looking at their offspring and seeing how successful they've been. Mm-hmm. So I just thought it was a neat study. It's data from Borneo Camp Leakey.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm looking forward to finding out more about this study. It's a 44 years of data. So,
wow.
Yeah. So I just, you know, it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. And I'm looking forward to reading a more in-depth article about it.
Yeah, there's a primate sociology component to it. I mean,
yeah.
If they're releasing some orangutans into a local... into this area where it's a distinct, it must be a distinct subspecies or distinct mm-hmm. species. And then they start interbreeding. Maybe it's because, I mean, normally they wouldn't.
Right.
Unless it's subspecies or species that don't normally come into contact because of geographical
mm-hmm.
Reasons. So
there's a few of my bio finds.
Mm-hmm.
How about you?
Okay, let's see. Well, the next thing I was going to go into is Fukushima, but that's going to be
really?
Very long. Yeah. Do you have any other bio stuff?
I do. I have a bunch of short ones that just kind of caught my interest this time. So there is also a very short article, or it's kind of out on the web right now. It's quite popular. And it's about astronaut Scott Kelly. And he's returned to Earth recently, and he is going to be providing NASA researchers with a unique opportunity to study the long-term effects of zero gravity on the body. And it's like, okay, so what kind of deal? Like, yeah, this has been done before. However, Scott Kelly has a twin, and the twin is almost genetically identical to him. And it's, it'll just be a fun and crazy thing to see, what kind of information. And when we were talking about this earlier, I liked what you said, like, well, this is a case study. This isn't going to be, you know, a finding that maybe.
Well, I mean, it does cut back a lot of the variability that you normally have in comparing two people. But
mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was just opening it up to show you.
You just opened Conquer? Yeah. Or is that Ice Weasel?
I don't know what I opened.
Just close it. Go to Ice Weasel.
There. I won't go into anywhere.
Nope. But anyway. Just open it with this. No. Yeah, that one.
Okay. So that's one that I just thought was kind of fun. And if you go to Science News, you will see a picture of the two brothers facing each other, and you can see how much they look alike.
Yeah, they look pretty close.
So it's kind of a fun thing. And I think it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that little study.
Yeah.
And I think there was, oh, here's the other one. Should I go? Oh, so last week we talked about the Nanopore.
I saw that.
Pioneer.
That made me so angry. It's like I don't even want to talk about it.
Yeah, but I thought it should be mentioned.
Yeah.
And
this is the whole, well, go ahead.
Yeah. So Nanopore.
Where did you find this?
In science, by the way.
I didn't.
It was in Brief.
I first came across it when I saw your show notes.
Yeah. So it was in the Science News Brief, and the company that we showcased last week coming up with
Oxford Nanopore technology
has just been sued, and it's over patent infringement. And so I hope this doesn't freeze the technology up so that it's not accessible for, you know, the use.
I mean, I don't know the details, like such a but, you know, patents are so, it's like companies that have all this money, like buying up all sorts of patents and then doing nothing with them.
Right.
And then suing other companies and companies suing each other over patents.
Right.
Without ever doing any research or anything, it's just like in their portfolio, and
right.
There is no way that's helping innovation.
Well, that's what broke
so
my heart.
Wrong.
I'm like,
yeah.
This is such a cool innovation.
Yeah. Although
and
I have
it
to
has
s-
far-reaching
yeah.
impact
yeah.
on human health,
yeah.
and
those laws should just be taken down.
Yeah. Anyway,
I think
they're ones that have not kept up with the trends in our society.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, we have to say in this specific case, we don't know.
No.
It had to do with a patent on the actual pore-forming technology, I guess.
Right.
So, anyway.
There was another article on the Zika virus, and it was by Gretchen Vogel, March 4th. And it overviews what they found so far about the virus, and
you had several Zika virus articles.
Yeah, and so there were two, but the one was more symptoms, and it was not as Zika specific. And so the one that, one article, the one that I just mentioned, by Gretchen Vogel. She does an overview of what they found so far. And so one of the things that they found is that the babies that have been infected by the Zika virus, the mothers also had amniotic fluid that was infected by the virus. And that those children ended up with microcephaly and the decreased growth of brain tissue. And so recently in Johns Hopkins, they've taken adult stem cells and they've tweaked them.
Those iPS cells, right. Induced pluripotent stem cells.
Right. And they made them into more of a neuroprogenitor cells, so more of what the brain cells would be. And they infected them with the Zika virus, and within 3 days they had 85% contamination rate.
Yeah, they're basically doing that with many different cell types and showing that the virus preferentially infects the one type.
And
do you notice, did you recognize any of the other cell types that as particularly interesting?
Yeah, so the other cell types that they looked at were, you know, ones that, like liver and...
Oh, I didn't see the liver.
Oh, you didn't? I thought I had just seen it.
No, it could be. I didn't see the original article. I just looked at your notes just before coming here.
Yeah. So they looked at other ones. What did you want to mention about the different
tissues?
The fetal
kidney.
Yes.
Because kidney cells, aren't they the ones that are, like, for the, not Ebola. Well, yeah, it was the Ebola research. I remember a while ago, a long time ago, we read a book about Ebola, Marburg, and all of those hemorrhagic fevers. And, you know, where they come from, you know, where you've had infections in different places in the world, and... You know, one of the tests is always the kidney cells, how well they infect those.
I think I misspoke. I do not think they did test liver cells. That was my mistake.
So I didn't totally understand. They mentioned embryonic stem cells and undifferentiated iPS. Okay, so I understand. Okay, no, sorry. I understand. So embryonic stem cells. So what's the undifferentiated iPS cells?
There's two studies. So one, they created the cell types in a sense that they coaxed them to grow.
They used iPS cells.
Right, iPS cells to do it.
Right.
And in the second study, they actually used cells from patients.
Oh, wait, that was just a control.
Yeah.
They had iPS cells. They turned them into... neural progenitor cells, and then they got infected, and the ones that were not turned into neural progenitor cells did not. But then it said immature neurons derived from neural progenitor cells.
Right, that's why I said in the Brazil study they actually used...
they were less susceptible.
Yeah.
So it's like they have to be mature? That's what it sounds like. Neural progenitor cells. Anyway.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
It is.
Might not be as complicated as it seems. It's just we might be missing a couple details
about it.
What exactly the cell types are.
So it's good that they're doing these studies and trying to really figure out how this virus is impacting. Mm-hmm. The bodies. It's very sad. As I was reading the article, they had a picture of a mother and a child, and it was just very sad to think.
Oh, sorry. I made a mistake. It's immature neurons derived from neural progenitor cells are less susceptible. Yeah. But the neural progenitor cells were susceptible. Am I mixing two studies here?
Maybe I...
Anyway.
The other one that I hit, because it was big last year, and it's kind of quieted down, but the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, and it continues to emerge, and it's talking about the survivors and the long-term effects of the survivors. And I didn't really think of the long-term effects. And they mentioned a few in the article, like joint pain, neurological problems, and eye damage. And again, in the article, it was mentioned that many men harbor Ebola RNA in their semen after they have recovered, far longer than imagined. And at one point we heard it was up to 6 months, but maybe that's, they didn't restate the time, so I'm not sure. And with particular groups, they tried this ZMAP, and I guess it's used with patients that are infected with HIV. And they enrolled a few people, but in the study,
are you sure ZMAP is used for HIV/AIDS? There was a conference on HIV/AIDS.
I thought it was.
And people working on HIV/AIDS also worked on Ebola.
Yeah, maybe I'm wrong. Anyway,
it wasn't from your notes. It wasn't. It didn't.
It maybe I read that. About it, but so didn't it, put
yes,
it in.
Could be.
So,
It'd be weird because it's ZMAP's an antibody cocktail, right? I mean, I know nothing about it except from your notes. But if it's antibodies, presumably they're targeting Ebola,
right?
Which, therefore, they would not be able to. I mean, the whole point of having antibodies is that they're specific, so they don't attack you; they attack the disease only.
Yeah. And the ZMAP, because it was started late, they weren't able to have sound statistical studies. So, just a few points that I found. So, what articles would you like to go to next? Because that kind of ends my biology section.
I think Fukushima.
Fukushima? I really liked that article.
That was... you saw the robots one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you see the one about the evacuees?
I didn't.
I should do that one first.
Okay, how about you do
because
that one
first? Because
it's
much broader, and if you wanted to cover the robots then.
Okay.
It gives you a really clear picture of what's happening. So the earthquake that caused the tsunami and then all that was in 2011. So that's about 5 years ago. And some of the stats are pretty cool. It's not nice. They're not cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's just very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
16,000 people dead.
Wow.
That is a huge number.
That is huge. I had no idea.
Yeah. Over 2,000 missing. 127,000 buildings destroyed. I'm not going to go over damage ones because that, I don't know. So they evacuated everybody from around the plant.
Mm-hmm.
It's 150,000 people.
Wow.
That's like the population of 7 Brockvilles.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine what that would mean, like to try to evacuate people in those numbers.
So it's basically everybody within 20 kilometers of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been 5 years, right? And now they've done this humongous cleanup effort. I'm not going to find it, I don't think. But the government funded this cleanup. that included removing I don't know how many tons of soil and scraping down all the houses and stuff. And the whole thing was to get the radiation outside down to so many millisieverts per day or whatever of exposure. Then you'd be like, okay, so that's safe enough. But the people really aren't sure, and they're, and it's time for them to start going back to some of the places where on the periphery. And, you know, some of the people are like, well,
is it truly safe?
Is it truly safe? And so there's worries and people saying there's not enough education about what, you know, what the different levels mean. But even though that's the point of the article, there's a lot more about what happens. So you have different units, right? Unit one was the worst. That reactor, the core just melted when it overheated. And it just dropped to the bottom of the first containment vessel, which is steel, I think. It melted through that, fell down through the bottom, ended up in the basement. Units 2 and 3, not all of it melted, but some of the stuff melted and fell through and collected at the bottom. Unit 4 somehow made it through. Or I don't know if there's a Unit 4 or if Unit 4 is actually a storage container or what, but they thought, well, that got that the water was lost from there. They were afraid that some of it melted. It turns out they're pretty sure it didn't. So, oh, here it is. The plan is to reduce. They scooped up 9 million cubic meters of contaminated soil and leaves, washed down buildings and stuff. They want to reduce it to 0.23 microsieverts, so 230 nanosieverts per hour. That's the plan, anyway. Okay, so we're going to have a little bit of a water article, safe water article, coming up after Fukushima. Okay, so you have to see the picture. Oh, by the way, the article is from March 4th in Science. So you have to check out this picture on page 1019 on the right. There's a picture of the Fukushima plant area. And you can see this is the ocean, I'm pretty sure, because I looked it up on Google Maps. The plant is right on the ocean. There's all these what look like barrels.
No, right? I see.
They're totally all over the place. They're over the entire plant. Those things are 10 meters tall. So think of the high dive. On it, right? That's how tall each one of these is. Okay. Why? They're all filled with water. And the reason is that that fuel that melted and went to the bottom, it's still there. And if it's not cooled, it's gonna, it might even get through the concrete, which you know, it was starting to go through the concrete, they think. So every day now, they are pumping tons of water in there continuously still to this day to keep it cool.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
So here's a cool fact.
Yeah.
The sister plant of this particular nuclear power plant is in Wilmington, North Carolina. It has the exact setup, including how close it is to the ocean.
Wilmington.
Wilmington, North Carolina.
Isn't that sister plant
bizarre?
Yeah.
So when they started, you know, going through all of this, they were, you know,
So the water that they put in there, it goes through the plant top, ends up in the basement. But they then can't leave it there because it'll seep out into the ocean. So they're pumping it back out from the basement. And seawater, I guess, is coming in also. And so they're pumping that out also. And that's all contaminated. By the way, the contaminant is mostly tritium, I think. And they're storing it on site. And they're getting pretty much to capacity. Now, the thing is, right, they have plans to change this. I'll mention that a bit, but it's been 5 years, right? Just now, we're going to talk about the robots finally getting in to see what's happening, but they still don't know where this stuff is.
No.
And how bad it is.
No.
The plans right now are to start to remove the fuel cells in 2021 or something? I can't remember. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 2021, right there. That's 5 years from now. So there's going to be at least this much water more, except they have some plans to try to reduce how much water they're using.
Wow.
One of them is really cool, and it's used for digging tunnels for, like, putting in subways and stuff where you have ocean close by or a high water table. Mm-hmm. They put in all these pipes way down all the way to bedrock, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they put, I can't remember what it is through them, but it's to make them go super cold. Cold enough that it will freeze all the water anywhere between the pipes even. So they form a wall that's frozen. Anyway, I thought that was kind of cool.
That is. So when you were telling me about this,
yeah,
I found the part where they've put nearly a dozen robots have been developed for to get a closer look at the heart of the plant.
Yeah.
Some float, swim through pools that have formed in the building's bowels. I wonder why, because everything's being pumped in.
Yep.
And because of the constant need to inject water to cool the damaged core, two snake-like robots crawled through the pipes leading into 48 meters tall primary contaminated vessel, unit
containment
one.
Vessel.
Yeah. Yeah. Containment, sorry. Containment vessel. Thank you for the correction. To see how, what's happened there. And, one got stuck, but the video that they got back was like invaluable.
Sure. Because it tells them how bad it is.
And it's 25, civets per hour.
That, well, one place.
In one place, yeah, that it measured. So.
Which would kill you right away.
Yeah. That's what they said. Like, there's no way they could put a person even close to that. It would be enough to kill a person in minutes.
I mean, one of the reasons for the delay that, you know, even after developing better robots, the place where they sent in the first robots, they had to delay by like a year because. Mm-hmm. You have to get people close enough. You know, these robots can't be controlled from another continent. You have to set it all up. Communications is a big problem because these things are, you know, are concrete and stuff. And the place where they were going to deploy the robot, where you needed to have people to be there, had way too high of a radiation itself.
Right.
So you couldn't even deploy the robots at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, by the way, the amount of water they're holding 750 tons of water.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's, they're looking for ways of maybe removing the tritium or whatever.
That's amazing. So guess who they first contacted when they were thinking maybe we should use robots?
Well, the first place they looked at was their own people. But none of their robots
were capable. Okay. After they looked at their own people and no one was capable.
Yeah. U.S. military.
Yeah. Yeah. I was surprised.
They didn't do very well either, though.
No, nope, they didn't. And, but, you know, it's a process. And
I think the big problem is that they weren't developed
for the particular task that they had in mind.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you have to have certain sensors on there. You have to have certain modes, movement, and size, shape.
It's got to be able to make it over rubble.
Yeah.
And it's got to be radiation hardened.
And also they wanted robots to be able to clear. areas.
Yeah.
And
well, that's a different kind of robot, I'd assume.
It is. But, you know, it's like, wow. And it took to March in 2011, the first TASS robots was surveying the damage of the radiation. And since then, they've really, you know, expanded their robots and their use of robots in this particular case. And, you know, no one wants to see a disaster happen, but it's nice to see that they built up technology for really dealing with the situation.
Yeah.
And maybe in they'll be able to do to be able to help more in real time, like dealing with the, oh my goodness, we're having a meltdown now.
Well, I mean, that's the problem, you know? is that with these types of emergencies, in one of the parts in the article, it was like, well, you can't do science, right? Mm-hmm. You have to have the stuff ready to go.
Right.
Because you need to know right away.
You do. And so it's like they almost have to have, like, a little pack ready to move and then hope that they have something that's usable.
To a certain extent, I wonder if the technology wasn't ready when Japan... Because everybody thought Japan would have, right? They are so big on robots. You have the Honda one and so.
Yeah.
And I wonder to some extent, well, you know, a lot of the funding for those types of stuff just disappeared before they were finished. And I wonder if just the technology wasn't quite right yet.
Well, also, if, yeah, I think so. It's so specific.
Yeah.
And when I was going through, you know, the technology that they were, that finally was used to develop these robots came from all over.
Right.
You know, there was groups in, you know, Japan itself, and Massachusetts, UK.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks loudly to, you know, you have people with specialties around.
Yeah.
And they focused on certain things.
I was thinking just what's available for making them, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the electronics nowadays compared to just 10 years ago, it's like unrecognizable, some of the stuff
that's
with FPGAs and these microcontrollers that are in everything. Where before, it would be a big project just to design something. Now you just buy it off the shelf and you program it. On the other hand, there is maybe the possibility that the goals were too general.
Mm-hmm.
You need to make very specific robots to handle those particular tasks rather than the robot that's going to do everything. And it looks like they're going very specific.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, in the robots that they show there.
Yeah.
So there's two more things about this article that are really cool.
Yeah.
This is not the robot
I didn't mean
one.
To cut you off, by the way.
No. This was a good place to put it in, yeah. Mm-hmm. So do you remember... I'm pretty sure we did in the podcast one time, the muons, or maybe it was before we started the podcast.
Yes, those floating.
No, this is like when cosmic rays hit the atmosphere.
Oh, got it, yeah.
They form subatomic particles called muons.
Yeah.
And they pass through everything, but then they hit stuff. And some guy had started to develop the idea that, well, if you... Stuff that's denser absorbs more muons, so you can use it like we use an X-ray, but for much larger structures and stuff. They actually deployed it at Fukushima.
Really?
Yeah. They did get some valuable data on it, but they're closing down the whole project, I think, or maybe they're going to try something else. They had to deploy the stuff at ground level.
Mm-hmm.
And really what we want to know is what happened to the rods that are... melted through and now they're below ground level.
Right.
So, but it's just the technology, the concept of it, the science of it is just so amazingly cool.
That is.
Okay. And then part two you're going to love.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the evacuees now, some of them are having to go back.
Mm-hmm.
Is it safe?
Right.
Right. Did you see the student-led project?
No.
These high school students, they have, what is it? The Fukushima High School Super Science Club.
Nice.
That's its name, right?
Yeah.
So they figured, well, how are we going to know if it's safe? They set up this whole project where they started to wear these little dosimetry things. They got funding.
Good.
Right? It's become an international project. So there's 260 students from 6 schools in Fukushima Prefecture, mm-hmm. 6 from other places in Japan, 4 from France,
nice.
8 from Poland, 2 from Belarus, and they basically wore around these dosimeters for 2 weeks. And then they got readings off of all of them and compared
from all the
kids from Fukushima to all the other places, and they published it in the Journal of Radiological Protection.
Nice.
And concluded, nope, Fukushima kids are okay. So I thought that was really cool. That's because you're always writing the grants for
cool
the students.
Cool use
and stuff.
Of just like nice citizen-based
yeah.
science
yeah.
projects. Oh,
awesome.
I love it.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Nice.
Yeah. So the robot article is in the same issue.
Yes, it was.
I think we kind of covered it.
I think so. I think
so
we
it was
combined
a shorter
them.
Piece.
It was.
They have some cool looking robots.
They do. And really specific ones for what they wanted for ground clears. And
yeah. Move along?
Yep.
Okay. I think this one might be the Fukushima podcast.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right.
There's a lot of cool science happening there, and mm-hmm. and the disaster is really sad, and it's what happened, but then, you know, trying to prevent from happening again and trying to fix what's the problem there is just such a challenge, and it looks like mm-hmm. they're really tackling it.
Oh, yeah. So. Agreed. Totally agree. So the other big one? I really liked the Ground Zero article.
Oh, okay.
But do you want to go to that one right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, sure. That's okay. fine. That's totally fine. I might close down a couple of mine that we read because I'm mm-hmm. crowded here.
Yeah, I think I might have to, too.
Okay. Ground Zero. Okay. I'm at it.
Okay.
What is the Ground Zero article?
Okay. So, Ground Zero, you have, and I have to get it back to it too. So, you have this area in the Gulf of Mexico.
The famous dinosaur
crater.
Crater.
How would you pronounce that?
Chicxulub.
Chicxulub Crater.
Chicxulub Crater.
And it's... They expect that's the, well, it's the biggest crater, and they want to drill it, and they're going to get drilling rigs out there, and they're going to drill along the crater rim, and compare.
So it's the peak ring.
The peak ring.
Which is not what you'd normally think of as a crater rim.
Yeah.
Right? There's a ring on the outside,
uh-huh.
which is kind of its rim. And then there's a secondary one on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they want to drill into.
Yep. And it's this huge project, and it's been years in the building. And it's a $10 million project. And... It is the first time that this has been drilled just for geological study.
So did you, you saw the diagram, oh, by the way, it's from March 4th.
Yeah.
Science. So did you, it took me a bit to understand, but
my
finally.
My diagrams don't show up. Well,
Did you ever see the diagrams?
Yeah, I did. I looked at them. I copied them into the podcast notes as well.
But then they didn't show.
Right, because of the reader.
It's, at first I didn't understand. Did you get what was happening? Because I finally figured it out. It's, the diagrams don't really, I think they're a bit confusing.
Mm-hmm.
So
tell me about them.
Yeah, so these peak rings only appear in the very largest craters.
Right.
Everywhere in the solar system. And there's only 3 on Earth.
Right.
And the theory is...
But this one's the most pronounced?
this is the only one on Earth we can measure.
Right.
There's
That's
only
what I was
three
thinking.
On Earth. The others are just, they're way older.
Mm-hmm.
They might be.
Right.
There's one in Canada that's a lot bigger than Chicxulub, but it's basically only know it's there from geology of the ground. There's no formation there or anything. So I think the idea is, okay, so a meteor or asteroid or something hits the ground and it hits it with so much force it buries in and everything in the center melts. And it's like this pool. And because it comes down and hits with so much pressure, then this molten rock and whatever bounces up and comes straight up and forms a column.
Oh, yeah, like a water droplet.
Exactly.
Like
in high-speed videos.
Yes. So I remember seeing something about this.
Yeah.
And how it does have that. You know, an equal, for every action, there's an equal reaction. So when that force, it
well,
has
that's
a reaction,
tricky because action-reaction is a very specific concept from Newton.
Yeah.
And this has to do with hydrodynamics.
Right.
Fluid dynamics. So it's not necessary. It's way more complicated than action-reaction. Of course, action-reaction is part of it, but, you know, on the microscopic scale for each molecule.
Yep.
Anyway, so this shoots up. So that's what's happening in the center, right? The force also pressed the outside out.
Right.
Right. And now, I guess within seconds of this happening, then the center, which is this huge towel, starts to fall back down on itself. And it's because it's so huge. It comes down with velocity and momentum, and then when it gets to the bottom, it shoots out towards the outside. But the force that pushed the outside up caused an unstable situation as a ring around it. And so now that, at exactly the same time, starts to come down and shoots towards the inside. And where this one coming down from the center and towards the out and the outside coming towards the in, when they where they impact each other in a ring, they go up a little bit from where they hit and then they freeze. And that's what makes the peak ring.
Okay.
And
they expect to get more.
That's one theory of why they get the peak ring. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't. It wasn't obvious to me how they could tell if that theory is correct. But one thing they said, well, if you look at rocks in the peak ring and you have older rocks and then younger rocks and then over older rocks, one above the other, instead of well-layered, it would be evidence for that mechanism of peak ring formation. Yeah, I can see that, but they're not comparing it to any other mechanism, so I have no way of ascertaining why they would think that. So, did you have anything else from it that you found interesting? There's a lot more there.
Yeah. So this area was previously drilled in the 1950s for actually oil.
Is it Pemex?
What?
What's the Mexican company?
Oh, I can't remember.
I'll find it. You go
the
ahead.
Actual company. Also, in 1991, there was the Hildebrand and colleagues. They went around the village of Chicxulub at the site of the cataclysm, and they found quartz crystals that were showing, you know, the impact, or samples, or indicated the impact. And then they just kind of sat around. And so it's like, wow, they were, you know, they were kind of on the edge of discovering something, but then no one really got back to that particular project.
Pemex is the company.
Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of makes sense. I mean, they were looking for, well, no, I guess it doesn't. I mean, Pemex, I'm not surprised, right? They're looking for oil.
Yeah.
And then when they found volcanic rock instead of oil, they're like, oh, well, there were volcanoes here.
Yeah.
Which, of course, it wasn't volcanoes at all. It was molten rock from, and quartz crystals from the impact melting.
So,
and then, yeah.
And just to give you a time frame of this particular project, it was actually first proposed in 1998. And then...
funding, is it?
Yeah, the funding didn't happen for a while. In 2005, they got $2 million to do some remote sensing and seismic explosions to help figure out what, you know, the structure of the ring and that. And then, you know, it wasn't until now, today, that they're actually out there doing some major drilling right on the...
For this purpose.
Yeah. So, you know, it's... I'm always amazed with, if you look at truly when they first proposed the project and the application, it's... There's some years that have gone by. It's almost 20 years.
Or 1980 is the first time, according to this, where the... Well, I mean, they must have known about the iridium layer around the entire world from before that, but that's when they have it marked as Luis Alvarez and others first calling attention to that layer. Possible material from an asteroid. 1980.
And I think it was last week where we're... Or the last podcast that we had, we mentioned about the microbes and looking at the microbes that they were finding in the core samples to determine what was living at certain times. And they hope to be able to look at microbes as well and be able to report back some of those findings. So it was just, as I read through, I'm like, this is just a really neat little adventure.
They're drilling 1,500 meters down.
Yeah.
They're going to reach the peak ring at 800 meters. Mm-hmm. That is a long ways.
Isn't it? And, yeah.
The thing, so they're drilling offshore. It's, they implied that the only reason was because getting permits for drilling on land.
See, I did read that.
I was like, really?
I know, I'm like...
And then not having to deal with the dirt roads. It's like, there is no freaking way that...
Like, it's easier to go out
the expense of putting an oil rig is less than dealing with dirt roads. Yeah. I cannot imagine.
I can't imagine.
But,
anyway.
And, yeah.
I was really shocked by that, too.
Well, I mean, I assume there's more there, but... It's like, huh. Okay.
Okay. So you had another article that I did not get to touch much of.
Uh-huh.
And it was on...
Oh, the Anthropocene?
Well, I thought I was actually going to go back to... I guess that would be a nice one to do.
Or right the water. I just saw what you had up on the computer.
So we didn't touch on several of your articles. What order would you like to go in?
I'll do the Anthropocene.
Okay.
Because I'm going to do it in 2 seconds.
Okay.
So, this is just a neat theory. There's not much there. It's from Science February 26th. And it's basically an article arguing that when we're making decisions about environmental impacts, we should think about the evolution of animals and allowing... You know, right now we think about what's best for now and what's best for people. And we should think more broadly than that. We should think outside of our own species. And we shouldn't think of natural expanses that are just good for other species, but what will provide a good evolutionary path into the future. my mom, right? And it's like, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's nice. I thought there was going to be a lot more about about specifics. And
yeah, it didn't talk about biodiversity or what, you know, kind of biodiversity would best support, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, yeah, it's neat. Very cool picture of a way to treat nature with respect is the caption. Human-made structures that protect. I mean, you know, this is the way you'd want all of those of your nature places to look. The picture is of, it's like a wooden walkway that's elevated above ground over these kind of really overgrown with bushes waterfall that has different levels, and I mean, it just looks really cool.
Yeah, it is.
It's in Croatia, the Plitvice Lakes National Park.
Neat.
Anyway, so yeah. Anyway, so that's all I want to say about it. I didn't have much about it. It was cool, but it could have been just a paragraph or two, the way it was written.
So, the next article that, how do you like your tap water? You talked to me about it in the car, this week, and I was wondering what you thought about it.
So that was a really good article, actually.
I did get to, like, read over it a bit.
The premise is pretty short, and so it can be covered pretty fast, even though there's a lot more in the article and stuff to look up. I mean, there's a lot there. I really liked it because you take your middle school kids over to the water treatment plant.
Right.
This would be a really good one to go over.
Yeah.
So here's the premise. In the United States, we treat our water. And there's very specific steps, right, that you know a lot better than I do from your trips at the plants that you go through. And in the last step, the water enters pipes that are taken out to your consumers for tap water. And in that water, there has to be chlorine by law or some chlorine-type disinfectant.
Right.
And that will stop any microbial growth from happening during that residence time in the pipes and storage and other places and stuff. Okay. Everywhere in the world where people are trying to get, say, you know, have a water distribution system, the whole point is to keep it safe. And so if you look at other places in Western Europe where the water is safe, then you find out that not every place puts chlorine in the water.
Right.
In particular, Netherlands, Germany, and Switzerland, it's not by law, so many municipalities have a different system.
Right.
In the UK, they put chlorine in the water. So, what's the difference? The difference is that if you have a water distribution system, the pipes, right? So first of all, it depends where you get your water from. If the water source is very clean, then there's less to worry about.
Right.
But the big issue is the distribution.
Right.
And if your pipes are old, and if they're not very carefully maintained and high quality, then you can have contamination from the outside getting into the pipes. Or you can have pipes that break and leak and then you get mixing, the stuff. In that case, you do need the chlorine, because if you don't have it, you're going to get outbreaks. Anyway, they looked at people in the Netherlands and different places. It turns out the ones with the lowest rate of waterborne diseases, diseased outbreaks, they looked specifically at outbreaks, was the Netherlands, where they don't use chlorine at all. And there was definitely no correlation between using it or not. So,
but the age of the pipes.
Well, no, because they don't have they had the best well, so the age of the pipes was much younger in the Netherlands, right?
That's what I was
thinking. That is, yes, you're right there. But the age of the pipes didn't necessarily correlate with outbreaks. Why? Because people that have older pipes that tend to break more put chlorine in their water, United mm-hmm. States and the UK. The UK sounded horrendous with some of their pipes being like, some areas, the average being 80 years old, other areas, they don't even know.
Oh, no. Pipes
are so old.
And then you have groups that have replaced all their pipes since the 1970s, so they're only like 33
to 37.
That's more than Netflix.
Yeah. So there's good and bad in both situations. Mm-hmm. So in our situation in the U.S., one of the bad is if you have chlorine in the water, so you get the taste of the chlorine that some people mm-hmm. don't like. It turns out it combines with organic matter in the water.
Right.
And you get carcinogens and other things.
Right. There's byproduct formation.
Yeah. And so that's not good from a health point of view. From a person's point of view, probably it doesn't matter. But from a public health point of view, it does matter, right? Mm-hmm. If you expose, we have over 300 million people in the U.S. If you, you can bet there's a lot of human problems caused by putting the chlorine in the water.
Mm-hmm.
But removing it is not the solution.
Right.
Because if you just remove it and you don't treat your, or change your pipes and everything, you're going to have a hell of a lot worse system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reason for these laws is because of cholera and...
Right.
What was the other
typhoid.
Big one?
Typhoid.
Typhoid, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you look at Netherlands and some of those other places where they have very good distribution system that are kept up to date and everything, their water can cost 3 to 4 times as high as ours.
Wow.
Right. So, philosophically, I'd rather have a good distribution system and not have the chlorine in the water.
Yeah.
But, it's easy to say that when you're like, mm-hmm. you pay for this.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you have that philosophy about everything...
Right.
You end up with not having enough money to do everything.
Right.
So it's a little bit, it's not obvious what the mm-hmm. solution is. And it might depend partially from where your water sources are. Although I can't imagine the Netherlands having water sources that are any better than ours.
I know.
But anyway. So, yep, that's all there is to that article that I found really interesting.
So I noticed two other articles of yours, and I think they kind of go hand in hand, where you have for innovation, no magic, in 3% rule,
yeah.
And then you have the flagship accelerators bid for better beams.
I'll do the 3% rule first, because
okay.
I can do that fast.
I didn't read the flagship one, but I did read a little bit of the 3% rule. I was just very curious.
Yeah, it was a neat article. There's, mm-hmm. it's neat to look at, it's one of those where it's neat to look at stats and everything.
Yeah.
But basically, it doesn't really tell you anything. Mm-hmm. It's from February 26th.
Right.
And basically, there's been this rule of thumb, I would call it, that if a country spends 3% on R&D, then it's in good shape. Because you'll get innovation in the future from the money spent in the R&D, presently. And then you have some places like Israel and South Korea, they mentioned, I think, as being just awesome with 4%. In the U.S., we've never reached 3%. We've mm-hmm. been at 2.8 to 2.88%.
Mm-hmm.
And the article is just pointing out that maybe the 3% rule doesn't mean anything, because in actuality, it's looking at just specifically the government expenditures, and there's government policy that also affects whether there's going to be innovation or not, and there's, certain societal trends and so on and so mm-hmm. forth, and so it's an interesting critique of it.
Mm-hmm.
But Yep. I don't know, there's not much. I don't really want to go starting the numbers stats right. of this percent and this right. percent. But, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
And on to the accelerator.
Yeah. Did you want to do this one?
I didn't read it.
Oh, you didn't read it.
No, that's why okay. I had to ask you about
so,
it.
So, actually, I think this one's going to be pretty fast, too. I didn't, since I, that was one of the first ones I read since our mm-hmm. last one. It's kind of neat to know what the technology is that's out there.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, I should mention the article first.
Yeah.
It's from February 26th also, and it's about accelerators that are getting upgrades in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And they compare the ones we have here to some of the ones in Europe, which are competitors for discoveries
mm-hmm.
In science. This is not for commercial use or anything. So there's two X-ray synchrotrons. There's what they call an X-ray free electron laser, an mm-hmm. FEL, and a neutron accelerator. I keep thinking to myself, how do you make a neutron accelerator?
Yeah.
I mean, don't you need to have a neutron? You can have slow neutrons and fast neutrons, and you can have neutron sources that will generate those one or the other. Mm-hmm. But how do you accelerate a neutron? I mean,
yeah,
it's neutral.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but I didn't have time to go into it. Anyway, so there's this advisory panel that makes decisions about, it's not decisions, it's like propositions of where the money should be spent, and then mm-hmm. the Department of Energy usually goes along with it. So they have all these upgrades planned. All of them are in the over $100 million. The highest is $1.3 billion. That's kind of high, though.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, it's one of those things, like the discovery of particles is kind of race between two different, between different places. And there's
right.
some, there's one in Sweden, the Max 4 synchrotron, that's also getting some upgrades. There's a European synchrotron, radiation
right.
facility in Grenoble in France.
Oh, neat.
That's, which is cool. Yeah, I didn't finish the article. No, I did. What else did I want to mention? Well, just one of the applications, so like what kind of science do they do with this?
Mm-hmm.
One of the ones is, I guess, with certain types of X-rays, because if you can get the energy higher and very fast pulse, then by pulsing onto chemicals that are undergoing reactions, you can get data about what the intermediates are.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way to get that data from chemical means, because they're some of the fastest reactions,
right.
and the transition states are very short. But I'm reading between the lines of what they explain. I'm trying to imagine. I think that's one of the main
mm-hmm.
areas of research for one type of
right.
all these. Anyway, so I don't know. I'll be much more interested when articles come out about findings that they've made with these.
Okay. Okay, so should we go on to future plans?
Yeah. I had some Linux Voice ones that you decided you didn't want to do. Not interested in SAS or GNU Make.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guess I'll just close these down.
Pretty cool.
They were on my list, but you just ignored it.
No, you can talk about them.
Actually, I really didn't have much to say.
Oh, okay.
I use Make for everything, so I thought it was kind of neat.
Mm-hmm.
But, boy, Make files. It's more like well, not a rant or, but just like a, you know, so the article about, I'll just do the make one. Skip the SAS. SAS was because of our own website.
Yeah.
It's a way of making better HTML. But make I use for everything. I guess it was first written in 1976.
Oh, wow.
Which explains why it has all these just really complicated things in it that seem, to someone who's new, just really hard to understand. Things like using the at character to execute a command silently and all sorts of other stuff. Anyway, the article was really good explaining.
Good.
One thing that I have noticed when I get a make file from someone and I want to build something is usually I'll just delete half of it and try to build it up or delete more and more and see if it still works
right.
until I get something I can understand. Anyway, this article was, by the way, from issue, can't find it, issue 25 of Linux Voice. It was really handy. It explained some stuff.
Neat.
So, on a very basic level, which is good for me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's all I have.
Yep. Okay. So, future plans.
Future plans.
So, what's coming up for you, Patrick?
What's coming up for you? You have a nightmare computer situation going.
I do. It's ongoing. And I will deal with it. I have a sporadic internet connection just when I think I have it solved.
Your computer was working like perfectly for like years.
Yeah, and then I let Patrick touch it and it hasn't worked the same since.
What?
I'm teasing. I am totally teasing.
Do you know why? Is there something that started to happen that it started? It just drops you off the network.
Yeah.
Just over and over.
Yeah.
And then it puts you back on then and drops you off.
Yeah. That's okay. I'll figure it out after everything settles.
I guess there's nothing to talk about there.
Nope.
Okay.
So Patrick is going out to Falls Lake again this weekend.
Last time before our O-meet.
Yeah, and he's done a fantastic job getting everything together.
The map is finished. I put the numbers in, finally.
Usually we do a lot of the work together.
Not this time.
Not this time at all. But Patrick has been just an overachiever.
You've had a broken foot.
There. Yeah, so I've been laid up with a broken foot.
I haven't been an overachiever. I just, you know, did what had to be done.
Mm-hmm.
We said we would do it. I think it's a really good course.
Yeah.
It's totally flagged.
Nice.
When I ran it for the very first time last weekend, and it was not as bad in terms of thorns. So,
which is really nice. Like, Falls Lake is like, has the thorns that must have been around during Jurassic Park.
They're dinosaur thorns.
Yeah.
And then our ARDF boards have been late. There must have been a snowstorm or something.
I think so. And so they have not arrived.
No, they might arrive tomorrow.
Yeah, which would be nice.
So
I'm taking a group of students to Washington this week, so that's going to be exciting.
Yep.
It's been pretty tense coming up to the trip, and I'm looking forward to
Actually being on the trip.
To be on the trip. So that'll be fun. So I guess that's all for news right now.
That's it.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.